This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Matthew. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in the Gospel of Matthew chapter 19 with this edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
Notice the difference between the 6 a.m. workers and the 11th hour workers. The early birds had haggled and negotiated. They wanted a guaranteed contract, whereas the later laborers trusted in the owner's character. Notice they just took him at his word. You remember what he said? He said, well, whatever's right, I'll give it to you. And they trusted him. They said, okay, we believe in your character. We don't need a contract. We'll just take you at your word. That's enough for us. And this is how heavenly rewards work. Guys, it is grace that brings us the heavenly reward. Not justice. Not fairness. It's grace. Grace is better than fairness. I hope you're not foolish enough to settle on what's fair. I hope you're not saying to God, well, God, I just want what's fair. You're going to get hell. If you want what's fair, he's going to send you to hell. With the things you've done, the sins you've committed, I mean, you don't want fairness, friend. You want grace. You want love that's on the house. You want love that you can do nothing to deserve or earn or receive. That's a gift, a free gift to you from God. Don't ever settle for fairness. Have faith in God's generosity and in God's grace. Hey, when it comes to receiving heavenly rewards, always better. It's better to trust in God's character and depend on His generosity and rely on faith and grace than it is to want a guarantee from God. God will always surprise you and He'll always be good. But notice too, if the early morning workers had kept their focus off of the latecomers, they would have gone home happy. The jealousy crept in when they looked to the other person's reward and not to their own reward. You know, when we used to go out in the driveway and play basketball, you know, the older boys had to obey the rules of basketball. I mean, they couldn't double dribble, they couldn't travel, they couldn't just take the ball and run in and shoot it. You know, they had to dribble. They had to play basketball. I had to play basketball. But at the time, Mac, he was just this little guy, and he was shorter than everybody else, and he was at an unfair disadvantage. He was playing with his dad and two older brothers. And so I would always let Mac kind of run in, and he could run around. He could get the ball and run around and shoot it, you know, anytime he wanted to. He could foul his brothers with pretty much immunity. But they would always, Jack and Nick, they would always start screaming, it's not fair. How come he fouls us and I can't foul him? How come he double dribbles and I don't get to dribble? And they couldn't understand the difference between the two. Hey, when God chooses to be gracious to one of His kids, it doesn't mean that He's being unfair with the rest of His kids. It just means that with that one child, there may be some extenuating circumstances. There may be something special that God is doing in that person's life that He wants to accomplish. You know, maybe he's younger. Maybe he's disadvantaged in some way. But God deals with each one of us individually, and we really get in trouble when we take our focus off ourselves and God and start putting it on other people. That's what this parable teaches us. The parable emphasizes our faith, our focus, and God's freedom. It teaches us God's sovereignty. God can allocate His rewards as God well pleases. As Jesus put it, is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with my own things? I mean, it's the landowner's money, and he can do as he pleases with his own money. Here's the bottom line. All that we receive from God is more than we deserve. If God, for whatever reason, chooses to be more generous with one person over the other person, that's His prerogative. Who are we to argue with God's choices? Faith, focus, freedom. Verse 17. Now Jesus, going on to Jerusalem, this was His final pilgrimage to Jerusalem before His crucifixion, took the 12 disciples aside on the road and said to them, behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn Him to death, and deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify. And the third day he will rise again. And it all went in one ear and right out of the other for the disciples. I mean, Jesus is explaining his death while the disciples are thinking about his kingdom. And the Lord's focus is on his passion. The disciples are fixated on their own promotion. That's what we find next. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. And he said to her, "What do you wish?" And she said to him, "Grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and the other on the left, in your kingdom." Now the lady's name was Salome. And her two sons were named James and John. And Mark's gospel seems to imply that the two boys put her up to this stunt. I mean, they're thinking in their minds, how can Jesus turn down a mom on her knees? Salome comes worshiping Jesus only because she wants something from Jesus. And I wonder how many of us, that's what motivates our worship rather than a pure heart and a pure love for him. But Jesus answered and said, "You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" They said to him, "We are able." Now notice, their mom asked, but Jesus answered James and John. He's talking directly to them. Obviously, they were behind her request. And Jesus tells them that he's about to drink the cup of suffering. He's about to be baptized in the salt water of persecution. Are James and John also willing to suffer persecution? I mean, those who are great in the kingdom are those who are willing to follow in Jesus' footsteps. There's an old Roman coin that has pictured on it an ox in the middle, flanked by an altar on one side and a plow on the other side. And the inscription on the coin reads, "Ready for either." You see, the goal of Christian discipleship is to be ready for either. To drink the cup of sacrifice in one gulp, the cup of Christian martyrdom, or to be willing to sip from the cup of sacrifice every day, a little at a time, and to lay down my life in faithful service. We need to be ready for either. Service or sacrifice. You know, when I read Jesus' words here, it sobers me. I wonder if I'm really ready. If I were called on to suffer for Jesus' sake, to even die for Jesus' sake, would I be ready? It surprises me how presumptuous James and John were, how confident they were of themselves. They said to him, "We are able." They had refused to even think about the cross, and now they're ready to carry one? It's interesting, in Acts chapter 12, we read that James was the first of the disciples to be martyred. King Herod killed James with a sword. He did drink the cup of suffering. And years later, John also was asked to drink this cup. He was arrested by the emperor Domitian and was boiled in hot oil. John miraculously survived. Apparently, he was a hard-boiled guy. He was eventually exiled to the island of Patmos. But both James and John did indeed end up drinking deeply from this cup of suffering. And so Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with, but to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared by my Father." And when the 10 heard it, they were greatly displeased with the two brothers. James and John, they were trying to move up the apostolic pecking order, and it had ticked off the other disciples. Not necessarily because of principle, mind you. The other disciples were probably angry. They didn't think of this idea first. Why don't we send our mother to him? But Jesus called them to himself. And it's interesting how Jesus handles these ambitious disciples. I think you'll find here that he doesn't throw water on their fire. In other words, he doesn't quench their ambition. Rather, he places the fire back in the fireplace. He puts their ambition back in the proper context. You know, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be great for God. I want to be great for God. I hope you want to be great for God. There's nothing wrong with having that ambition as long as you have the proper definition of greatness, of true greatness. And what Jesus does, he doesn't quench their ambition. Rather, he defines greatness. And he said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them." Now, Jesus draws a contrast among the ungodly, the pagans, the world without God. Greatness is gauged by a person's control and dominance and manipulation over other people's lives. The Gentiles, quote, lord it over, or they boss people around. That's what it means to be great in the world's eyes, to pressure people and to badger people into doing your bidding. They force their agenda on other people. It was once said of a man, his life was now perfection, his ambitions all complete, never mind which direction, he was in the driver's seat. And for some people, that's all that matters. It's just being in the driver's seat. This is the problem with power. It's a drug. It's addictive. It's intoxicating. It has a life of its own. You've heard it. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the world loves this power. The idea is to get in the driver's seat and stay seated in the driver's seat. In verse 26, Jesus says, "Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to be great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave." Greatness in God's kingdom is just the opposite. It's not sitting in the driver's seat. It's being the one who washes the car. God measures greatness not by the degree to which I can manipulate folks, but by the degree to which I minister to folks. Greatness doesn't pressure people. It sets people free. It doesn't put people down. It lifts people up. It's not intimidation. It's humiliation. Greatness in God's kingdom is not climbing the ladder. Rather, it's holding the ladder so that someone else can climb. As D.L. Moody once wrote, "The measure of a man is not how many servants he has, but how many men he serves." In verse 28, Jesus finishes his thought here. "Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." Jesus is our example. The Son of God had all power coursing through his veins. But what did he do with that power? He reached and he grabbed a bowl and a towel and he washed his disciples' feet. Here was the God who hung the stars in the heavens, and yet he never pushed people around. He was so unintimidating that the little children played around him. And if the Lord of glory came to serve, how can we be justified in any other lifestyle than that of a servant? It's been said, we may easily be too big for God to use, but we can never be too small. Greatness in God's kingdom is not about being big. It's about becoming small. It's not about growing muscle. It's about showing mercy. Greatness in God's kingdom is not about standing up, but about stooping down. It's about serving God through serving others. Verse 29. "Now, as they went out of Jericho, a great multitude followed him." Now, Jericho is 18 miles east of Jerusalem. It's in the Jordan Valley. It's an oasis, really, in the Judean wilderness. Jericho is a beautiful city. It's lined with these gorgeous palm trees. Jericho was also called the City of Roses because of its beautiful flowers. And Luke 18 tells us that this next event happens as Jesus was nearing Jericho. Now, Matthew and Mark, they say something different. They say that this event happened as they were leaving Jericho. Luke says it happened as they were entering Jericho. Matthew and Mark say it happens as they were leaving Jericho. The apparent discrepancy is easily resolved when you understand a little history. At the time there were actually two Jerichos. There was an ancient Jewish city that was just east of a newer Roman city. Matthew and Mark were Jews, and so they referred to the older city. Luke was a Gentile, so he spoke of the newer city. Thus, the event took some place between the two cities as they were leaving the old and as they were entering the new. One other point about Jericho. There was a bush that grew near Jericho that supposedly had medicinal value. And it was used by the ancients to treat blindness. Thus, there was a very large population of visually impaired people hanging out in Jericho. Verse 30, we meet two of them. And behold, two blind men sitting by the road, when they heard that Jesus was passing by, cried out saying, "Have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David." Now, the Greek word translated cried out is the word krazo. It's the same word used to describe a woman undergoing the pains of childbirth. So, I mean, these guys were screaming. Then the multitude warned them that they should be quiet, but they cried out all the more saying, "Have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David." I mean, these guys are disturbing the peace, mind you. They're making a scene. I'm sure these two blind men had heard of Jesus, but they had never dreamed that they would actually have an opportunity to meet him. And yet suddenly now, here they are on the same street with Jesus. And so they begin screaming at the top of their lungs, hoping he'll notice them. Even when they're pressured to shut up by their peers, they remain determined. This could be the only shot to ever reach Jesus. And they're going to give it their best shot. You know, here are two men with no eyesight, but who have tremendous insight. Jesus is on their street. And no matter what anyone else thinks, no matter what anybody else says about them, they're going to get his attention. They will not be scared off. They will not be shut up. These blind men are going to keep screaming until Jesus notices them. This is the kind of determination you and I need to show when we seek Jesus. So often we're shut up or scared off. Hey, Jesus is on your street. Do you know who's on your street? Do you know what's available to you tonight, right here, right now? Why would you back off just because of what someone else might think? Why not scream to the top of your lungs until Jesus sees and hears you? And it worked, verse 32. So Jesus stood still and called them and said, "What do you want me to do for you?" Notice, suddenly, the sun stands still. That happened one other time. Here again, though, the sun stands still. Jesus is headed to the cross. He is 18 miles from Jerusalem. Understand this. The climax of his ministry and God's plan for the ages, the salvation of man, is just around the corner, just down the road. Yet the cries of two blind beggars arrest the Son of God and cause him to stop. Boy, to me that's encouraging. I mean, that says to me that whatever we need, I mean, God's, there's a song on the radio now, you know, "God's too busy." I've been listening to the country station. I got to explain this now. I mean, the Braves now are on the country station. You know that. And so I'm listening to the Braves game and I leave the car radio on. So I come back out and listen to the country station. And there's this horrible song on the country station that says, "God is too busy." Not the God I know. Not the God that I read about. Not the God that was entering Jericho. He wasn't too busy. I mean, he's on the way to be crucified. He's on the way to save the world from its sin. But he's not too busy for two blind beggars who scream at the top of their lungs and get his attention. And they said to him, "Lord, this is what we need, that our eyes may be opened." And so Jesus had compassion and touched their eyes, and immediately their eyes received sight. No LASIK. No surgery, no medicines, no bandages, no corrective lenses. They go from blind as a bat to 20/20 vision. A miracle. Anne May Pinnica was born in 1919. She was born blind. And for 62 years, she lived without sight. She never saw a blue sky. She never saw a green pasture. She never saw a snow-capped mountain. She never saw her husband's face. Then in October of 1991, Dr. Thomas Pettit of UCLA performed a new type of surgery on Mrs. Pinnica. He removed a rare case of congenital cataracts from Mrs. Pinnica's eyes. And for the first time in her 72 years on earth, she could see. After her surgery, she had 20/30 vision, good enough for an elderly lady to qualify for a driver's license. Ann May Pinnica made this statement after her surgery. She says, "Everything was so much bigger and brighter than I ever imagined." Now imagine these two blind men. They had been blind since birth. Now, suddenly, they can see. Everything is bigger and brighter than they ever imagined. For the first time, they look around the City of Roses and they can see the beautiful flowers there in Jericho. And they can see the palm trees. And they see the deep blue water of the Jordan. For the first time, they can look off and they see the majestic mountains of Moab across the horizon. But for these men, it was even more special. For the very first sight that they ever saw was the most magnificent sight that you and I will ever see, the face of Jesus Christ. One day, our eyes will be open. The spiritual cataracts that have so limited our vision, that have limited us to the material and physical world, will suddenly be removed. And immediately we'll see, as we've never seen before, at the first sight in eternity, our eyes will be open and we'll be able to look into the face of our Savior Jesus. Now I want you to notice the last four words in chapter 20. The best has been saved at last. Here is such a beautiful thought. And they followed Him. Their eyes were open, and they set out to follow Jesus. The next day now, they're with Jesus. They're following Him. They arrive in Jerusalem. He's riding His donkey down the Mount of Olives to the hosannas of the crowd. They see this. They see all this happening. The same day, Jesus enters into the temple and He drives out the money changers. And they're there to witness it. They're new eyes. They're fresh vision. They see these things. On Monday, He curses a fig tree. And these blind guys, they actually see it wither with their own eyes. Later in the week, with their opened eyes, they see Jesus arrested. And they see Him crucified, die a bloody death. And then 3 days later, they're still there among His followers. They see Him rise from the dead, victorious over death, hell, and the grave. Hey, these two blind men will see it all. Talk about an eyeful. And here's my point. When Jesus opens your eyes, when you see His face in your heart, hey, it's just the beginning of the wonders and the glories that He wants to reveal to you. Following Jesus is an adventure. There are all kinds of marvels to behold. So, when you journey with Jesus, here's my advice to you. Always keep your eyes wide open.
Thanks for listening to Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Matthew, where we see the life and ministry of Jesus unfold. One of the key themes in Matthew's Gospel is how Jesus fulfills the promises made to Israel in the Old Testament. From the very beginning, Matthew presents Jesus as the long-awaited Messiah, the King who has come to restore God's kingdom on earth. In Matthew 5, Jesus delivers the Beatitudes, which outline the values of His kingdom. Values that are often upside down from the world's standards. For example, while the world prizes wealth and power, Jesus blesses the poor in spirit and those who mourn, showing that God's kingdom is built on humility, mercy, and purity of heart. These teachings challenge us to view our lives through a different lens, one that prioritizes spiritual richness over worldly success. Sandy Adams Radio is a ministry of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain, located in Atlanta, Georgia. To hear more of our teachings, visit our website at sandyadams.org. If you're in the Atlanta area, we'd love for you to visit our church family this weekend. We have services at 9:15 and 11:15 a.m. every Sunday. You can find directions to Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain on our website by clicking the About tab. We hope you join us again next time on Sandy Adams Radio.